I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hope in Darkness is a podcast that addresses sensitive topics, including torture, abuse, and human rights violations. Listener discretion is advised. Contact with home was great, but after that first conversation with his parents, Josh also began to get more contact with his fellow inmates, usually because they just happened to be doing work near his cell.
The inmates are the people that do everything in the jail. If there's something that needs to be fixed, they find one of the inmates that can fix it. Maybe he worked with building houses, he was a contractor. Or maybe it was just people that can clean. Maybe he works with electrical.
Like the guy Tammy and Josh met when they came back to the prison after that first court appearance, who was fixing a fan and talking on a cell phone. One day, about a month into his time at El Helicoide, while Josh was sitting in his cell by himself, an inmate who was sweeping the floor brought Josh a piece of paper.
The piece of paper basically stated this lawyer's name, and this lawyer told me that she had talked to my family and that they wanted her to represent me.
Easier said than done. First, he needed to confer with Tammy, and they were only able to communicate by passing notes back and forth, hidden inside the worn-out label of a reused 2-liter bottle once a day.
We finally came to the conclusion that we both were in agreement that we'd allow this lawyer to represent us. Now, the next fight that we had was to be able to be seen by this lawyer.
The inmates at El Helicoide were supposed to be allowed visits from attorneys twice a week.
A visit on Tuesday, and you'd have a visit on Thursday. The time limit that you could see your lawyer is just an hour.
Depending on the circumstances in both the jail and the country, the start of that visit might get delayed, but it still ended at the same time.
There's times where they wouldn't allow the lawyers to come up until maybe 10:50, so you have 10 minutes to meet with your lawyer.
The attorney, who worked for a human rights organization, kept the pressure on and prevailed. The Holtz got their time with her.
We were talking with her quite a bit at the very beginning, and she just always seemed very positive about everything that was happening. I guess it wasn't the first American that had been brought to this jail, but normally they only last a month to 3 or 4 months, and then they're set free.
Josh held on to the promise of his 45-day hold. If he could just make it 45 days, he'd have his next hearing, and he and Tammy would be freed. After all, he thought, the evidence was planted. He and Tammy were innocent. Then came word the hearing was canceled.
When I found out that they weren't going to take us to the courthouse, I was really nervous, and so was my wife.
The judge had decided there was enough evidence to send Tammy and Josh to a pretrial. They didn't even have a date for that. Just word that the whole thing was deferred.
And that was a really hard day for me. I honestly thought that we were going to get our freedom.
I'm Becky Bruce, and this is Hope in Darkness, Episode 7, Working the System. In this episode, we'll talk about what happened after the hope of a 45-day stay and a quick release evaporated. We'll take you step by step through how Tammy and Josh learned to navigate prison life. Those steps include new legal counsel, improved living conditions, help from the inside, and help from the outside, courtesy of Tammy's mom, Maria. More after the break. Around the same time as the canceled hearing, about 6 weeks into his imprisonment, Josh learned his stay in solitary confinement was finally over. he was moving to a new cell.
This room was probably 15 by 15. When I entered the room, I saw two twin-size beds and a column right through the middle of both the beds. I saw another table where there was a TV, little tiny TV. They went and they put me over in the corner by one of the twin-size beds. And that's where I was to stay.
Not on the bed?
No, not on the bed. I was on the floor. There were three people that were in this room with me at the very beginning. The one that was in the first twin-size bed when you entered onto the left, his name was Colombia. He had been there for over 3 years.
Colombia was accused of the 2014 murder of a Venezuelan lawmaker.
And then the person that was in the corner on the right side of the room, his name was Franklin.
Josh had met Franklin, a political prisoner, before they became cellmates. In fact, Franklin had lobbied for Josh to be moved into better conditions. He and his fellow political prisoners didn't think it was right for Josh to be kept alone and deprived of things like visits from the outside world. We don't know for sure if that's why Josh wound up getting moved, but it very well could have been.
And so my relationship with him was all right. Yeah, I still wasn't 100% comfortable with him just because I really didn't know who he was. But one thing that was really nice was he was someone that was fluent in not only Spanish, but as well as English. So I was able to communicate back and forth.
Franklin's charge? Terrorism.
When he kept walking and passed the big column that went through the center of the room, there was another twin-size bed. The person that was on that bed goes by the name of Buñuelo.
Buñuelo was a nickname, roughly translating to the donut. His real name was Claudio Giovanni Jimenez Gomez.
And that's when I found out that he was one of the top 10 most deadliest people in Venezuela. And I'm sleeping maybe a foot away from him.
He had come to El Helicoide a few months before Josh, accused of killing a police officer with a grenade, threatening others, then holding a woman and her daughter hostage to avoid arrest. Josh put his belongings on the other side, next to Buñuelo's bed, on the white tile floor. He had no idea what to expect in his new surroundings.
That night was very interesting, because Colombia was not in the room for most of that day.
It was Colombia's birthday. For that reason, he was allowed out in the halls and into other parts of the prison.
You can get a lot of things in the jails that you probably shouldn't have.
Somehow, Colombia had gotten a hold of some alcohol.
And he was drinking heavily. And he drank so bad that he became violent. And he started fighting with the guards. They beat this guy up bad. They beat him up really, really bad. And they ended up bringing Colombia into our room, opening the door, and they just threw him in there.
Colombia hit his head on the table holding the TV and knocked over what little water they had. The beds, set up on milk crates, went flying.
And then they slammed the door behind him and locked it. And he looked bad. He had, both of his eyes were black. They were just swollen shut. He was bleeding all over. And we ended up cleaning everything up and just putting him back on his bed. And he slept on that bed for probably 3 days without really even moving.
Was he just sleeping off the alcohol or more seriously hurt? Hard to say. Like Tammy and Josh earlier, Colombia did not get any medical attention beyond what his cellmates were able to provide. It was quite an introduction to Josh's new room. It was also somewhat educational.
After that happened, everything kind of got a little crazy in the room. They knew that after something like that happened, that the police officers would come in the room and they'd do a raid. And they'd look for anything they could look for, because they didn't want any photos or news to get out about what just happened. And so the next day or two, the people that were in our room had moved their cell phones and other items out of the room and into other rooms, so that way when the police officers would come in, they wouldn't find anything.
The guards came in during a time when inmates would normally be allowed to have visitation in the hallway. They shut the door and locked it, and closed a curtain over the door so no one could see in. They tore the room apart.
They're literally grabbing your stuff, shaking it, making sure there's nothing in there, and then just throwing it. They don't care where they're throwing it to. They just get it out of their area.
The guards left and locked the door behind them again.
And now we were left with this bomb that just went off in our room and things were just everywhere.
Josh realized he had a lot to learn about prison life. But he was surrounded by guys with more experience, both in Venezuela and at El Helicoide. And one of them, unexpectedly, would be instrumental to his survival.
Bunuelo, the person that was next to me, spent a lot of his time on the phone. And so I didn't really communicate with him. And I kind of got a vibe from him at the very beginning that he was kind of on edge. And I think it was because he was trying to read me and trying to see who I was. He didn't know if I was a snitch. He didn't know if I was someone that was sent there to watch him, or if I was just, you know, some other normal prisoner that he could get along with.
The longer he was there, the more Bunuelo started to open up. He was curious about Josh. How did a gringo like Josh come to learn Spanish? Josh told Bunuelo about his Spanish-speaking mission outside of Seattle.
And I told him, I said, well, I served a mission for my church. And during that mission, I was asked to speak the Spanish language. And so I slowly began to learn Spanish. When I got home from my mission, I met Tammy, as of course you know, and she helped me learn a lot more Spanish. She goes, wow, that's really interesting. He goes, what's a mission?
So Josh explained, and over time, built a friendship with his cellmate.
And one of my favorite stories about him was, I told him about when I get out into the mission field, after you get done with the missionary training center, and you're out in the field now, and you're just there. And you have a person that's there with you, and that person we normally call our dad, because he teaches us things. And he normally calls us their son. And so I just remember he looked at me and he put his hands on my shoulder and he said, well, then you'll be my son and I'll be your dad. And I'll teach you everything there is to know here in prison. And he honestly did. He taught me a lot of things.
Squeaky clean Josh Holt got schooled by one of Venezuela's most wanted. Lesson one. How to read the guards.
You had to know what was going on with them to know whether or not they were going to come in and raid your cell.
Lesson two, don't be stingy.
He said, what do you do when someone comes up to you and asks you for a roll of toilet paper? And I said, well, I'll just tear some off and give them some toilet paper. And he says, no, they'll kill you. I said, what do you mean they'll kill me? And he says, well, how do you know how much toilet paper they need to wipe themselves? And I said, well, I don't know, but it's my toilet paper, and so I'm only going to give him as much as I want to give him. And he goes, well, that's one of those things that you have to fight over. Do you want friendship and people that are be on your side, or would you rather fight with people because you don't want to give them toilet paper? And I said, okay, that makes sense.
Lesson three, get a side hustle.
While you're there in prison, you had to kind of figure out a way to make your own money. And so I'd sell juice packets. And something else that I noticed from people, so tons of people would buy cigarettes, but no one would ever sell lighters. So I said, well, what the heck? I'm going to start selling lighters then. And that's what I did. I started selling lighters and I sold a couple boxes of them.
There were more practical lessons too, like how to manage without toilet paper or a toilet. By folding newspaper into special shapes to, well, catch everything. Getting to know the other men better gave Josh more opportunities to call home. And Franklin, in particular, was generous with Josh.
He also had a phone, as well as the other two gentlemen in the room. And periodically they let me use their phone.
He felt bad always borrowing their things. He tried not to abuse the privilege and to find other opportunities to stay in touch when possible.
There was another guy, a political guy, that was in the prison with me that came one day to the door and, you know, wanted to see if I needed anything. And so I told him that I just really wanted to communicate with my parents. And he said, you know, I think I can help you with that. And so a couple of days later, he came back with a phone and he said, I'll let you have this for, you know, the rest of the afternoon. I just need it back after visitations.
When the guy came back for his phone, Josh felt a renewed sense of hope. His mom had updated him on everything she was doing to try to help from the U.S. But he also felt impatient. Why was it taking so long? Josh asked the other man.
And he told me that I shouldn't worry yet. That the process that I'm going through is normal. That there in Venezuela, there is no system. There is no justice system. The way the judges work are either with the government or through money. And so that I didn't need to worry until I passed about 7 or 8 months. And then once I got to that point, then I need to start worrying.
The time to start worrying came sooner than he thought it would. We'll be right back. A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Tammy also settled into prison life at El Helicoide, where she shared a cell with 32 other women. Like Josh, she slept on a mattress on the tiled floor. But unlike Josh, she had a key ally close at hand, her mother, Maria. Unfortunately, you won't hear Maria's voice. She is living in Ecuador now, but she doesn't have consistent access to internet for a Skype or Zoom call, and she doesn't speak English.
My mom saved us throughout that whole time. She did a lot of things for Josh and me. I'm sure Josh's mom would have done the same. The difference is that she was thousands of kilometers away and couldn't be there because her security was going to be in danger.
Her support for the couple started with little things.
After being there for a couple weeks, we were able to have Tammy's mom send us in some toothbrushes with different visitors that knew who Tammy was. And so I was able to get that from her along with some bars of soap and some shampoo, a razor, and that type of stuff.
Then Tammy earned the right to actually see her mom. That wound up creating a little friction in her relatively new marriage because Josh was not allowed any visitors early on. He couldn't sit in on Tammy's visits with her mother. But with time, Maria's visits proved to be beneficial for both of them.
When visitors come into the jail, they have to go through this little line, and they basically take everything from you, and they look at everything that you have. But they're not always 100% thorough in what they're looking for, and it also depends on who it is that's there. And so if you butter up the guards, they won't worry about looking through your stuff because they just know who you are and are worried about what you're giving them.
With financial aid from Josh's parents, Jason and Lori, she found ways to sneak items into the prison when she visited.
It took her months to befriend these guards.
Again, Josh's dad, Jason Holt.
So every time she'd go to the prison to see him, she'd take them a treat. You know, here's a sandwich, here's a Coke, here's a cookie, because they're starving down there.
My mother-in-law was a great cook, and so she would just cook different things and just give them one tub, and then she'd give us one tub.
Mom started to win over the guards, the workers. She always made cakes. She's a pastry chef. She'd arrive, a cake for you, a cake for you, and she'd give a little piece of cake to whoever, with the condition that they didn't search what she brought in our shopping cart.
Josh will tell me if this is true or not true. This, what I've heard is eventually they just stopped checking her bags and she was able to get stuff into them.
First on the contraband list, food.
We had to buy all his food, so we would get money to Tammy's mom, and she'd have to ride a bus to find the food, that which was, you know, the money wasn't a problem because we could get the money down to her, usually. But then she still had to be able to find the food and get it into him.
As you know, Venezuela was in crisis mode. Even the act of shopping for food was an undertaking, one that wasn't always successful. You might stand in line for hours on end, only to find out the food was gone.
So it's not like here where you can just go park your car or grab your groceries and put it in the back of your car. Like she left her house with an empty cart, and she'd take that cart around with her all day long, up and down hills, take it back home, which is back up a hill, and then take it back to us, which she had to go up a huge ramp just to get it to us.
And hope that she could keep all the food and not get it stolen while she's walking through town with it.
Mm-hmm. And so it was just extremely hard for her.
She brought us food every week. And she brought rice, raw food for me to cook, because many times the food they had there had flies in it or tasted bad or the heat would hurt you and it wasn't appetizing to eat.
Ella fielmente iba cada día de visita. Ella iba dos veces por semana. Ella dejó uno, ella tenía dos trabajos. Ella dejó uno de sus trabajos para cuidar de nosotros, para llevarnos comida.
She faithfully went every visiting day, two times a week. She had two jobs, and she left one of them to take care of us, to bring us food, to be there with us. There came a time when she could visit us four times a week, and she did it.
Todo eso caminando, jalando un carrito de comida tan pesado. Eso hizo que ella se lastimara sus rodillas.
She had to do all of it, walking, hauling a cart of food so heavy that it hurt her knees. Then Lori and Jason sent her a knee brace, something to make walking easier. This helped her to have a little more support. She did this for 2 years, two times a week, climbing that mountain with a cart full of food.
Dos veces por semana, subiendo esa montaña con un carro lleno de comida.
Maria had done a good enough job of catering to the guards that she could sneak food in pretty easily. But she still had to be stealthy, especially when the couple wanted cell phones of their own. Again, Lori and Jason sent money to Maria. Maria found the phones and did what had to be done to get them into El Helicoide.
Muchas veces mi mamá tuvo que inventarse la manera de pasarse los teléfonos.
Many times, Mom had to invent ways to get the phones in. Mom used her pants. She used her leggings under her pants, and she placed, no, not internally, but in the division, the space between her legs. Mom would place the phone there. She tried to walk more softly and delicately because the walk was hard on her muscles, but that's how she passed the phones inside.
Pero ella sí nos pasaba los teléfonos.
And I remember the first phone that I got was this little tiny pink flip phone.
A couple months into the ordeal, Josh was able to check in with his Utah family on a daily basis.
And so that's kind of what I do throughout the day. Sometimes I would text them. And at night, when I was able to finally talk, I would text them and say, yeah, I'm ready to talk and we can talk now. And so then they'd call me and answer the phone, and I'd talk to them for an hour or 2 hours. That was kind of our thing that we do every night.
A couple of months into their ordeal, Josh was able to check in with his Utah family on a daily basis without having to borrow phones from his cellmates. And Josh and Tammy finally got to have regular communications with each other, messaging back and forth the way they did at the beginning of their relationship. Josh and Tammy's relationship got another boost in a roundabout way from one of Tammy's cellmates.
Ella fue mi primera amiga.
She was my first friend. I talked to her. She was the first one I started having dealings with because I had an obligation to get along well with her. I had an obligation to get along well with her because, first, she was a murderer. She had killed a functionary of a Sabine.
They called the guards Sabines after the intelligence agency for which they worked, a name that also applies to officers for that agency. Tammy doesn't know why this woman killed the officer, but she does know that, like many other prisoners, the woman's rights were taken away, maybe more so because she killed one of their own.
A ella le fue terrible los primeros.
And they treated her terribly the first 7 months. They raped her. The guards raped her. They beat her. They didn't give her food. She was like a piñata. They never took her to court. She was there for 7 months, locked up for having done it, or violating her rights because despite being a murderer, she had rights to be taken to court, rights to be judged, rights to an attorney. During that time, they didn't take her anywhere. Or that is, Sabine took her case as one of theirs, and they decided what to do with her. And after that time, after raping and beating her so many times, they put her in the cell where I was. Then she had already been there a year. I was there one night.
Entonces ella ya tenía en ese cuarto un año y yo tenía una noche.
This woman's treatment and that of the other women in the cell changed when she began having an affair with the warden.
That relationship that she had with the superintendent made the time more, made it easier for all the women in the cell because we had more peace.
They also got more privileges as a direct result of that relationship.
Each time that he passed, all the women would make a line to say, "Superintendent," one after the other. "Superintendent, I want a DVD." And they let me get a small DVD player with a screen, a portable DVD player. Yes, then I could watch my TV all morning, all the time I wanted.
Gracias a esa relación, él fue tan permisivo.
Thanks to the relationship, he was very permissive. One woman received a 21-inch flat-screen TV plasma. Another received an electric kitchen. Then he let us. The other girls asked for that kind of electric domestic items and a fridge, a mini fridge. She, the girl, she received food from him, and he was always sending food, like McDonald's, pizza, Chinese food. He was falling in love with her or something, but that made our life marvelous.
Enamorándola o no sé qué. Pero eso hizo nuestra vida maravillosa.
Once the affair began, guards rarely raided the women's cell, making it less likely those items they obtained would be confiscated.
No solamente buscan por teléfono.
They didn't just look for phones. They also look for money, and they take your money. They'd also take, because those that did the search were women, in the women's cell were police women, then they'd take your shampoo, your conditioner, your deodorant. They'd take pretty clothes, earrings, necklaces, bracelets, watches. We had little, but to us it was gold.
Oro.
Tammy's friendship with the woman in her cell eventually translated into more freedoms for Josh, in a way.
I spoke to her. Look, ask the superintendent if I can visit my spouse. She talked to the superintendent, and he decided to talk to me. There, I was seen as the wife of the gringo. I was known as the wife of the gringo in the jail. So she said, look, the wife of the gringo wants to talk to you. And one day, a guard says to me, the superintendent wants to talk with you.
El comisario quiere hablar contigo. Entonces él me dice, tengo entendido que tú quieres tener visitas con tu esposo. Yo le digo, sí.
Then he tells me, I understand that you want to have visits with your husband. I say, yes, we haven't seen each other. We only get 30 minutes. I'm not allowed to talk to him, eat with him, or nothing like that. Then he tells me, starting next week, you can have 2 visiting days with him. Then I could leave 2 times a week. The visits on Wednesdays were from 1 to 3 in the afternoon, and on Saturdays, they were from 11 to 5 in the afternoon. Then we had more time.
Entonces ya tenía más tiempo de visita.
It wasn't exactly what they pictured when they thought about their first few months of married life, but it's what they got. Occasional visitation and some life lessons on staying alive behind bars. Josh and Tammy settled into their respective lives at El Helicoide. Months flew by, and they lost track of time. Next time on Hope in Darkness.
Tammy knew. Tammy had a clear idea that she really wanted the girls out.
Hope in Darkness is written and produced by me, Becky Bruce. Additional producing and editing came from Nina Ernest. Sound mixing by Trent Sell. Our executive producer is Cheryl Worsley. Original theme composed by Michael Bonmiller. Additional voice work provided by Rebecca Cressman and Alex Keery. Special thanks to Josh and Tammy Holt and their family for sharing their experiences and story. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Hope Darkness Pod or online at hopedarkness.com. And your feedback is always helpful. Drop us a rating or review wherever you listen. Hope in Darkness is a KSL podcast.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.